the What Bitcoin Did podcast.
Hello there from a very noisy New York City. How are you all? I've just got into the city this morning. I took the red eye from San Francisco after interviewing Nick Szabo, which was pretty amazing. Can't wait to get that out. There's been some great feedback already. I think people are pretty excited about this interview. Anyway, welcome to the What Bitcoin Did podcast, which is brought to you by the Mighty Kraken, the very best place to buy and sell Bitcoin. I'm your host, Peter McCormack, and today I've got an interview with Dan Tapiro discussing why both gold and Bitcoin are important. But before that, I do have a message from my amazing show sponsors, and don't forget to give them a listen. It's because of these I get to fly to places like San Francisco and interview people like Nick Szabo. So give them a listen, give them a shout out, check them out. So firstly, today's show is brought to you by BlockFi, and as the month comes to a close, like every month, I get pretty excited to find out what my interest is looking like with my interest account. I've had the account now for nearly 6 months. I've made a nice, tidy bit of Bitcoin on the side. I know it's not for everyone, but you know, I really like it. And they've added so many cool things to the product recently. They've dropped minimum deposits. They've removed the early withdrawal penalty. And you can now choose to receive your interest in the currency of your choice. So with BlockFi, you can earn interest on your Bitcoin, ETH, and GUSD. And if you are interested in finding out, I always say do your own research, then head over to BlockFi.com, which is BlockFi.com. Also, today's show is brought to you by the very amazing and mighty, mighty Kraken. Not just sponsoring What Bitcoin Did, also sponsoring my other show, Defiant. So thank you, Kraken. They are the most trusted place to buy and sell Bitcoin. Are you using Kraken yet? If not, come on, why not? They have the best security in the industry. And for you traders out there, they've got the most comprehensive set of tools available. They've got Kraken.com, the best place to buy, sell, and trade digital currencies. They've got margin trading with up to 5x leverage. They've got futures. They've got indices. They've got the Kraken OTC desk for large trades. They've got CryptoWatch, where you can trade on multiple exchanges from a single platform. And for you advanced traders out there, they've got the best account management service in the business. There is no better place to trade. So join me in supporting Kraken and head over to Kraken.com, which is K-R-A-K-E-N.com. Okay, so onto the show today, and it's with Dan Tapiro. And he's come up as a request a few times recently. A few people have said, can you get Dan on? So yes, I checked him out. Absolute pleasure to get him on the show. I could have probably talked to Dan for hours, and hopefully we're going to do this again at some point. I think we both agreed it was a great show. But Dan is a global macro investor, and he is a co-founder of the Gold Bullion International, and he's a relatively new Bitcoin bull. And this interview is massive. Dan is from the world of traditional finance and institutional investors, and in Bitcoin, a question that is often thrown around is, when are the institutions coming? With the recent launch of backed futures, along with LedgerX and CME, institutions now have real on-ramps, and they could be getting exposure to Bitcoin. So why aren't they? Why aren't they coming in the numbers that we thought or maybe hoped? Is it that the technical barrier is too high an entry? Is it that people can't get their head around a physical money like Bitcoin? Is there not enough educational content out there? Or as Dan suggests, will this pass many of the older institutional investors by and facilitate a huge wealth redistribution? Personally, I hope it's the latter. I see Bitcoin as money for the people. So a bit more on Dan. He first heard about Bitcoin in 2013 while working as a macro investor, and he initially wrote it off. He thought the market was too illiquid, had too small a market cap, and it was just a plaything for VCs. But after educating himself on Bitcoin and hearing Rao Pao and Vijay Boyapati present the bullish case of Bitcoin, his opinion started to change. So I got Dan on the show to find out what it was about Bitcoin that changed his mind, and as well as discussing gold. We also talk about Twitter, Trump influencing markets, and what Dan thinks about the future of Bitcoin. So I hope you enjoy the show. Just a couple of notes. I'm now here in New York. I'm here for the Human Rights Foundation Freedom Forum. I'm going to be here until Friday when I head back to the UK. It's been another great trip and included the launch of Defiance, which is pretty amazing. Next month, I'm going to be back in the States. I'm also probably going to be heading to Hawaii. I've also got to go to New Zealand and maybe even Africa for my first time. So it's going to be busy, busy. Just going to keep grinding, keep hustling. If you've got any questions, do reach out to me. My email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com. Dan, how you doing?
Doing well.
Thanks for coming on the show. Your name's come up a lot recently. I think I've been asked about five times now. People have said, you've got to get Dan on the show. He used to be a Bitcoin hater. Now he's a fan. You've got to get him on. You've got to talk to him about why he's changed, why he's converted. So
I don't know if I was a hater, but okay.
A non-believer.
Okay, I'll give you that a little bit.
All right. Well, let's do the background first, because you're what people would call a gold bug, right?
Well, I don't know if I would say a gold bug, just because gold bugs are super ideological. only have one view and opinion and are not really open to other thoughts. I've been a global macro portfolio manager, and I've been in the hedge fund business for 25 years. And so have looked at all sorts of different assets, you know, at different periods. And, you know, I'm really looking for what I call almost like a step function change type of opportunity. And so, you know, I've been involved with gold on and off since the early 90s. And then in 08, started my own physical gold company with a partner called GBI, Gold Bullion International, which grew from, you know, I guess this is why people might think gold bug, but it grew from basically a presentation, a thought I had in my head, to a company today that has done over 1 million trades, has over 300,000 clients, and we make it easy for people to buy and store physical gold.
Okay.
So, yeah, I'm a businessman who's interested in the gold market.
Right. So you have an onboarding and custody service. That's the way I would think of it in the world of Bitcoin. You allow people to buy it and you custody it for them. And
yeah. I think that's right. We have seven different vaults where we lease space around the world. And you might be thinking I'm giving you a little more detail here than you need, but I'll
No, I want it. This is good.
So, you know, we have New York and Salt Lake and Zurich and London. And, you know, in 08, I was looking around for a place. I wanted to own my own gold outside of the banking system. And, you know, I had traditionally traded a lot with the big counterparties. And I called up, you know, JP Morgan and UBS. They're the two really large players. And I said, you know, I wanted to do a few million dollars. And they told me at the time that the minimums were 10 and 20 million. And, you know, 20 million was more than I wanted to allocate. So I started looking around, and there was really nowhere online. There was no platform that I thought was trusted, you know, that wasn't based in some weird place. And they said, wire your money here, and, you know, maybe you have your gold there. And so I said to an ex-partner that I'd started another business with, hey, what do you think about this idea? And, you know, because I'd really like to own it for myself in a secure way, in a jurisdiction outside of the U.S. And, you know, anyway, 2 years later, it took us 2 years to build that technology. I mean, it's a platform. And what we do is we plug into other people's distribution systems. So, for instance, our largest client and our first client was Merrill Lynch Wealth Management. And what we did was we built a system that plugs into theirs, so that, for instance, a financial advisor can, you know, who's sitting there in Ohio, his client calls him up and he says, hey, I want a kilo bar stored in Singapore. And the Merrill advisor calls up his screen, pushes a button, and then that's us. And the next day, that guy in Ohio has got his bar in Singapore. And so it's like I wasn't aware of Bitcoin in 08, but some of the things that motivated my interest in having physical gold the way I wanted it, outside of the system, 100% insured, you know, secured, you know, these are similar things that, I mean, they're characteristics of Bitcoin in a way, right? Mm-hmm. Of why people want to have Bitcoin.
Well, yeah, and also a lot of the Bitcoiners sometimes see it as a Bitcoin versus gold argument and always trying to say why Bitcoin is better than gold. I actually see it slightly differently. I just see that there are two very complementary assets that offer a similar kind of value, but with just different properties.
I think that's right. And in a way, a super intelligent and concise description. I mean, in theory, we could stop the interview right here.
We're done.
I mean, that's exactly right. It's funny how resistant people are to just that very simple concept. I think that's right. I mean, each has their own properties. I think I've said somewhere that, well, you know, Bitcoin is a very big thing, you know, and I think one of the things that Bitcoin is, you know, that comparison to gold. But I think just to be even-handed and to follow up with that comment you just made, you know, there are things that physical gold, their characteristics of it, that Bitcoin can't sort of replicate. And, you know, as an example, you know, physical gold can be, if you want it to be, truly off the grid with no record, no transaction record anywhere. You can also pick it up. So I could buy some physical gold, have it sent to my apartment in London, and then I can go pick it up and walk it around the street to another bank. And basically it's to another bank or vault or wherever. And, you know, with Bitcoin, what we're seeing now, I mean, we just saw how it was helpful in tracking that child pornography ring. You know, this concept I keep going on about, this truth machine. You know, Bitcoin really is a bulletproof ledger that tracks everything. Physical gold is mostly trackable, but, you know, there are people out there who don't want it tracked. It doesn't have to be. So, you know, that's one thing. Another thing is tax implications. Physical gold has different tax implications in all the different jurisdictions. And even within products in the United States, different products have different tax liabilities associated with it. So, and I don't want to say there are a lot of loopholes in that sense, but there are. And I'll just give you one example. You said you're in London often, and very few people know this, but are you a British citizen?
I am British citizen.
So you probably didn't know this now. If you're a UK citizen, you can buy the UK sovereign gold coins, okay? And they are free from tax forever. No capital gains, no income. There's no wealth tax on it. It's considered the money of the realm, like dating back to the 1700s. In 1700, they passed some law. I'm not sure about why it's that way, but, you know, GBI, we actually work with the UK Mint quite closely. And I mean, I thought this was incredible when I first heard about this. I mean, why wouldn't you have, I understand being a Bitcoin holder, and I think, yes, there's multiples more of price appreciation, but at some point you're going to pay tax if you sell any of it. Here you are with your, you know, UK sovereigns, zero.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that's incredible, don't you think?
Well, I do, but I mean, my bet on Bitcoin is that it will appreciate in value over the next 10 years before I sell any at a much higher rate, say, than gold. So, you know, whilst I'll have to pay tax, that's my bet. But I don't have anything against gold. And like, I perfectly understand why people have it and they store it and why they, you know, people have a basket of assets, especially if they're managing money. Just for me, you know, I'm not a wealthy person. So, you know, I've gone all in on the Bitcoin. But I'm interested in the gold, Dan. I've got some questions with you. Okay, so you custody it. So say I want a kilo of gold from you, Dan, and you say you custody it for me. Do you then just go onto the market and buy it and have to actually then physically have it delivered to your say, warehouse or vault?
You know, so you're talking about the specific logistics, and I guess it depends. So we lease space from Brinks, and so we're a large vaulter, so we get very cheap rates compared to what an individual will get for a smaller amount. So in a sense, we're an aggregating business. But it depends. You know, if you're buying your kilo in New York, maybe the same day we have someone selling it. So we just move it from them to you.
Yeah.
That, you know, the ownership. If it's a small vault, we're not really in any small vault. But if you were at a small vault somewhere, you know, and they didn't have the bar there, then, yeah, we would have it directly sent from one of the vaults where we do have the gold. This is a very flexible product. I mean, you know, you can have it delivered to your house. We deliver to over 100 countries. Think about that. And then you could say 3 days later, oh, I want to put it back into a vault in London. And, you know, I had it in New York. I took delivery. I looked at it. I put it back. I prefer to have it in London. So there's lots of flexibility. And we have 50 different products, as you know, different coins, bars, kilo bars, smaller little bit. Some people buy one coin. So the logistics just depend on the specifics of what you're doing.
No, it's really interesting. And say, what are the risks with this? So you know, one of the things Bitcoiners will say is, well, my Bitcoin can never be confiscated. My private keys. Would people ever worry about that? Is that something anyone should ever be worried about?
It's 100% insured.
Great.
So if your gold ever was stolen or confiscated, it's 100% insured.
Brilliant.
By Lloyd's of London. So you have no, especially if you're a smaller holder, you have no risk, I would think. Maybe if a government came in and took your gold because you had 400 or 500 million, maybe that might be more difficult. You know, that would have to come under a separate insurance agreement. But for, you know, millions, tens of millions. And believe it or not, a Brinks vault there's never been any loss. It's like they say Bitcoin has never been hacked. It's the same thing. No one has ever lost a single penny having their gold vaulted in a Brinks vault.
All right. So then why are you going to be offering Bitcoin alongside gold now? Are you going to offer a buy and custody service for that? Because that would be, what a cool business, right? If you were offering both gold and Bitcoin.
Right. So actually, we sort of do. And this is a funny story and maybe why I am one of the few gold guys who was exposed to Bitcoin. We had a young guy who worked with us very early on, who ended up being president of the company for a while, GBI, no longer with us, who, of course, a younger guy. At the time, he was probably 26, 27. And in 2013, 14, we actually had a digital gold product. We then spent, there was no demand, so the business went nowhere. So that was, we lost money on that business line. We then integrated with a company called BitReserve. This is 2014, which turned into Uphold.
Ah, yeah, I know Uphold.
Right. And so if you go to Uphold, you can still today, we were the first place that you could buy or sell Ripple or Bitcoin to buy or sell physical gold, silver, platinum, palladium. And it took us a year to integrate with them, but we did. So if you go to Uphold today, you could sell Ripple and buy palladium. And that's the functionality that we gave them, we built for them almost 5-6 years ago. But unfortunately, that business never really took off. And I don't know that I can explain it. It still is there today. It's not a big revenue driver for us. And you know, what we had in the very beginning, you'd find this interesting, is there were very small bits of money coming out of China, and they were buying, my guess is they were buying Ripple, and then they were selling their Ripple to buy physical gold, and then we would have it stored outside of China somewhere, right? So it was a way for them at the time. Again, I say this freely just because it's never turned into a big business. So, you know, the Chinese have nothing to, you know, I would have hoped it would have been a conduit for Chinese money to leave the country, to be honest, but it never turned into that. So, you know, we have it. Maybe, you know, we as a firm looking forward over the next 3-4 years really need to think about building out that business. I'll say one last thing. We did 6 months ago start a business with Equity Trust, which is an IRA firm. You know, like in the U.S., it's retirement accounts. You can set up an independent retirement account with this company, and we built this for them. We partnered with them in building this. You can buy, I think, any one of 8 cryptocurrencies for your IRA, which means that they're tax free. And that business actually has taken off in the last 6 months. So, I mean, it's mostly Bitcoin, but then we also offer 6, 7, 8 other ones. And that's in partnership with Digital Currency Group, Barry Silbert's group.
Mm-hmm.
But we built the tech for all of that. And that's been, there aren't too many places in the U.S. where you can buy Bitcoin in your IRA at a reasonable price. There are a few other people out there who are really, really gouging people, and I feel bad for them. I wish they knew about our product because they would be saving multiple percentage points. So we are sort of involved, but not as much as maybe we will be in the future.
Okay. So one thing that would be interesting for me to understand is, like, as I mentioned before, I was told that you were originally like a non-believer in Bitcoin, and you've kind of changed your view on it. Can you talk to me about that? Can you tell me when, like, you first heard about Bitcoin? What were your doubts about, and what changed? Because I think that's going to be a really interesting thing for a lot of people to hear.
Yeah. So the thing is this, is that being in the global macro money management world, I was aware of Bitcoin early. I remember it was on the front page of the FT at one point when it hit, I think it was 30 and then collapsed back down. I forgot what year that was. But my familiarity with it increased when GBI got involved. As I said, we integrated with BitReserve in 2014, and we were actually making little bits of money from, you know, the trading in Bitcoin and Ripple. So I was aware of it, and I thought, yeah, that's great, that's cool, you know. But the problem for me early, and really until recently, is just that the market cap was just too small.
Okay.
As a macro guy, you know, I've traded in markets that trade, you know, trillions of dollars a day. You know, the currency markets are multi-trillion dollars. The bond markets are billions, sometimes trillions. Even the gold market, I remember one day in 2011, I think traded over $1 trillion of gold and traded in maybe a day or two. So I've always positioned in these large assets, playing for, you know, big moves and big trend moves in large asset classes. So Bitcoin was more like a small DC, you know, I would almost say play thing. You know, it was like a tech stock trading at 30 cents. And so I was never involved in stocks. I don't trade stocks. And so I saw it, but it wasn't real to me. $5 billion, even when it hit $10-15 billion market cap, it was just still too small. So I'm like, yeah, that's cool, but it's not macro. And I've got all these other asset classes I'm looking at. So, but what happened was, when it went up to 18, 19,000, well, let me just say before that, being very involved with GMI, which is Raoul Powell's group, I think I was one of the original subscribers to his monthly newsletter back in the early 2000s, and he even covered me when he was at Goldman Sachs. So I've known him for, you know, over 20 years. And he had a session down in the Caymans. I think maybe there were 10 or 15 guys there. And there was one year, I think it was 2013, he presented the bullish case for Bitcoin, and so did a bunch of other guys. And so, you know, and those guys are probably pretty well known today in the Bitcoin space.
Yeah, that's Vijay Boyapati did the bullish case for Bitcoin. He's been on my show, and Raoul's been on actually as well.
Yeah. And they were early and very smart about it. And as I said, there were probably five or six other guys as well there. But still, I had this problem that it wasn't really big enough. And in fact, Raoul, he had bought it, as I said, around 300. He sold it around 2,000, 3,000 in the run-up, went up to 20. And again, it's been on my radar. I looked at it every day. And then earlier this year, really in January, I saw this thing, and I you know, it was down 85% from the high. And, you know, if you're a macro guy and you've looked at markets, different types of markets, your whole career, you know that when a market goes down 85, 90%, either it's a total bankruptcy or a fraud or a zero, and will be a zero, or it's really the buying opportunity. And like you saw this with like Thai banks in 1998 after the deval, the peg break in 97. You know, there are plenty of examples of it. And so I thought, well, Bitcoin's not a fraud, so I'm going to start buying. And I started buying it, you know, 4,000, 5,000, 6,000. So I bought all the way up. And, you know, the more you buy and the more of your personal net worth you put into something, the more interested you become in it. And what happened was, I just started spending all my time reading, digging into Bitcoin. And I was just blown away because I didn't realize that it was all the things that it is. You know, I mean, I had looked at the white paper years before, but I don't have any background in computer science or cryptography. I don't know how to code. I wasn't even good at math in high school, okay? So it was very far. It was a very far road for me. I mean, it was a long stretch for me to understand it. And so I just thought, oh, you know, I don't get this. This is for the VC tech geniuses out in Silicon Valley. So I gave up. And I think a lot of people give up. And I bought some of those early books that came out in 14 and 15, and they made no sense to me at all. So, but I didn't give up this time in, you know, earlier this year, because again, as I said, I had this position, which I still have, but the things that were available to read were helpful. And, you know, I read Saffedine Amos's book. That was helpful. Antonopoulos's volume 2 was very helpful. And, you know, this after the interview I did with Real Vision, I was introduced to the world of Twitter, which I had never been on Twitter. I had never tweeted, you know, until August or September, basically, of this year. And so there are, I mean, and that is an incredible community of, I mean, there are some geniuses on that, you know, in that world. I mean, there are also some goofballs. But, you know, to be able to read, you know, comments from Adam Back or, you know, some of these younger guys who are, I mean, unbelievably knowledgeable, that helped the process of learning.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of Bitcoin's problems, you know, people always say, well, what's the barrier to adoption? And I said this before, is I think, you know, when you're outside of Bitcoin, it's extremely opaque to get into it. Well, the language is hard to learn. It's like you're learning a new language. The concepts are hard, and there aren't that many people who are explaining it within a framework or context that makes it easy for, you know, what are called no-coiners.
Dan, listen, this is why I do my show the way I do it. I often get called, people are like, oh, Pete, you're an idiot, because I, you know, ask simple questions and try to get people to explain things. But I think people on the inside, they don't actually realize how, like, deep the rabbit hole is, how much knowledge there is. Also, people can be really hard on you if you get something wrong. So, for example, you might get sucked into looking at altcoins for valid reasons. I totally understand why people do. You might want to ask certain questions, and then people will just go crazy at you. And it's just like, well, come on, take a step back. Let's help people here.
Yeah, and I don't particularly mind that, because I've always been one who believed in strong debate. And you know, I was a history major and did a master's in history in school, and that whole, and then of course, being an investor, part of the fun for me is having an idea and then going back and forth in a real way with people who are, you know, who are the best at what they do and can provide insight and let me know where I'm wrong or I'm right. I don't know if you look at some of the places where I've worked and things I've done, you know, it's just one needs a thick skin to survive, number one. But it's more that I'm interested in the heated debate, you know. So it, just as an example, I mean, maybe about a month or two ago before the Hedera Hashgraph release, I asked somebody almost very simply on a weekend on Twitter, so can someone tell me, you know, what they think the pros and cons are of Hedera Hashgraph versus Bitcoin? And you cannot.
What? What did you do, Dad?
I know. But let me tell you something. It was one of the most interesting back and forth, because all of a sudden, this guy, Eric, on Twitter, this guy is some sort of genius as well. And he's probably like 28 or 29 and says he lives in Sweden or something.
Eric Wall.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a great guy.
Some missive that actually, you know, was incredible. And, you know, and then you had the pro Hedera people come out against him, and they were debating in the thread of my question. And so it's like, where this is also, you know, the power of Twitter is something that's also blown me away. I'm a 51-year-old guy, not naturally taken to all this stuff. But, you know, part of, like, the decentralized power of Twitter, in a way, is also, you know, similar to the decentralized power of Bitcoin, mm-hmm. in some way. I'm the decentralized aspect. And so to have this debate, and then Eric released something on Medium, and then the Hedera people released their, you know, response to that. So you can't get that anywhere in the world. And I guess my point is that, you know, 5-6 years ago, I don't, maybe that did exist, but I feel like the Bitcoin Twitter is filled with enough people at all the different levels. And I feel like it is a nice community. I know people talk about this toxic, this and that. And again, there's this Ethereum Bitcoin thing, but for the most part, I mean, I think it's a really nice community because people, you know, like you, you know, want to help people learn and understand and not just ask like, okay, well, how is Bitcoin going to be scalable? Like, that's the dumbest question. Some people, you know, people ask that over and over and over, but when you get to that place in the rabbit hole, you don't ask that question anymore because you understand what Bitcoin is, which is, it's much bigger than all that.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, Eric's a great guy. I mean, I was out in Oslo with Eric earlier in the year. We went to the Human Rights Freedom Forum. We went dancing together. He's a hell of a dancer as well. A lot of people don't know that. And he's going to be coming on the show very soon. But it is great. I love how you can go online and you can have... You can get into a debate and Eric can be there, and then you can have Safe Dean and Moose jump in, and then you could jump in, and then maybe Raoul will jump in. You've got this kind of global group of people all debating issues to do with Bitcoin. I think it's an amazing time to be alive to be able to do that. But I do find it interesting. I'll tell you what else I find interesting, Dan, was where you said you initially dismissed it not because of any of the fundamentals. You just dismissed it because of the market cap size. And, you know, you're a trader, essentially. So that was very interesting because I'd made the assumption you dismissed it as, you know, magic internet money, had no meaning. So what is it about the properties that when you were learning about Bitcoin, did you, you know, really come to appreciate? What was it that kind of grabbed you?
Yeah, you know, I would also say one of the other things why I knew there was something there was that some of the very best people in my global macro space who are around my age, maybe a little older, but around my age, moved into the space permanently. Dan Moorhead, he was at Tiger Management after me, and I've known Dan for 20 years. Mike Novogratz, Fortress was a global macro fund. He now has Galaxy. You know, John Burbank is also now very involved. So they were very smart younger guys who I respected who were moved into the space. So it also made it easy for me not to say, oh, it's magic internet money, because these guys, you know, they were real, you know, smart, good investors. So anyway, I'm sorry. I just wanted to, you know, it was maybe made a little easier for me because I saw my peers who actually had done all the hard work fall into it. And you said, so what were the properties?
Yeah, also, yeah, we're going to come back to that. I've got a very short question. You might be able to clear something up for me relating to Dan Moorhead. Do you know if he was into the 90s heavy metal band Pantera and that's why he called the fund Pantera, or is it a coincidence?
I don't know. I really don't know, actually. But I'm going to see him in a few days. I can ask him.
Can you ask him to come on my show? I can't get hold of him. I don't think he knows who I am, but I think he should come on. I want to talk about Pep.
He's hard for me to get a hold of these days, so I won't promise anything.
Well, find out the Pantera thing. But yeah, so what I wanted to know, what is it about the properties of Bitcoin that initially kind of made you go, oh, this is something?
Yeah, well, I thought when I got to a certain point where I had not realized initially that Bitcoin was really the culmination of 30 years of scientific and cryptographic research. And I have that timeline, and I saw this, you know, as a person interested in history and the evolution of things. When I saw that timeline, starting with, early with Cerf and Kahn and Ralph Merkle and then David Chaum and, all of these things, I thought, oh my gosh, this is like, it's an invention. It's a breakthrough. It's like, and then the fact that the paper solved the Byzantine generals problem, I was just not in that world. I was not aware of these things. So I thought, wow, it's super legitimate. In fact, it's I had been an academic at school, so it was like in the realm of an academic paper that actually had a real world application that, had, even that it had 1 or 2 billion or 5, 10 billion of market cap, I should have realized back then. But again, I had no idea. I just didn't do the super deep dive. So that for me was the light bulb that, like, wow, this is like the invention of electricity. And that immediately sort of sucked me in, because I thought, everyone who knows less about Bitcoin than me, which is basically a lot of people, even though I'm not, by any means even close to some of the experts, but I thought everyone else has no idea about this. And so I'm still way ahead of people generally. And so that got me very excited. When I'm really early, I had a farmland business in 06, 07 that I started. I was very involved in agriculture. It's sort of, I had the same type of epiphany. I thought grain prices were going to double for a certain number for whatever reason. And, and the same thing with gold in 05, 06, when I got very focused on gold. So what I'm saying is that feeling as a macro investor was the same of, wow, this is real and I'm early and I better figure out what to do right away.
Next up, I talk to Dan more about Bitcoin and gold, but before that, I do have a message from my amazing sponsors. Okay, so we're starting out today with Dropbit, and I've been sending sats out. I've done around 4 million now. I've got another 6 million to go. I'm going to be sending out 10 million sats in total, unlocking Lightning for people who've got their wallet. And also, they've got another cool, interesting update coming soon. I can't believe the rate they're doing these. I can't tell you about it yet, but I'm going to save some of the sats for that. But over the next week, I'm going to be doing another 6 million sats. But have you got it? Have you got Dropbit? Have you checked out their Lightning implementation? And also, they are now supporting Fetch 32 addresses. I love everything they do. I think their implementation is really, really cool. The UX for moving between Bitcoin and Lightning is one of the best I've seen. And add to that their ability to text and tweet Bitcoin to people. It's pretty fucking cool what they're doing. There is a waiting list for Lightning, so do hit me up on Twitter if you want to get access. I've got some sats for you. Just DM me. And if you want to check it out, it's available for the iPhone and Android. Just head over to dropbit.app, which is dropbit.app. Also, have you checked out Wire yet? Have you checked out my buddy Michael Dunworth's business? Sponsoring the show for nearly a month now. I really, really want to help those guys, help them succeed. So please do go and check out sendwire.com. Whether you're a solo developer or a large team, if you are looking to simplify user onboarding and offer users an easy, fast way to purchase Bitcoin, then you've got to talk to Wire. Since 2013, they have focused on taking care of all the heavy lifting in terms of compliance, payments, and liquidity, so you can focus on building your core offering. Have you got an idea for the next killer app? You want to crush it, or do not let the regulators kill it? To find out more, reach out to Wire or create a developer account at sendwire.com, which is sendwire.com. When you talk to other investors, you've got a lot of friends, macro investors and analysts and various people you talk to. amongst them, I'm assuming there are some naysayers, some who still, you know, they don't know Bitcoin, they don't believe in it, maybe they don't understand it. What is the kind of like rejections you're getting from people?
Almost all of them. And I'm talking about very, very successful guys in their endeavors. Almost all of them. You know, and that goes from money managers to people who are very senior in Wall Street to, you know, billionaire business people. They all kind of smirk a little bit, you know, and then I say, well, you know what, you're probably not really going to do the work that's required to really understand it. And then they're a little interested because I've goaded them on a little bit. You know, a guy who's very successful doesn't want to be told that there isn't something he can't understand that's related to money or business or making money or, you know, or what the new banking system might look like 10, 15 years from now, right? But very few, you know, even guys who might, you know, some people, you know, I would say part of that, it's not just that their fault, but you need to have the time to put into it. And if you're running a business or several businesses and it's 10, 12 hours a day, you know, I've been an independent investor for many, many years. And I've started two companies from scratch that were based on a macro thought. And I've been involved in probably 30 to 50 different, I would say, significant macro trades in my career over the last 28 years. So, like, this whole process, it wasn't that difficult for me to fall into it, right? Oh my goodness, light bulb goes off, lock myself away in a room, read 10 books, listen to 100 podcasts, you know, read 1,000 articles. And that's basically what happened. And it took months. And it wasn't the only thing I did, but it pretty much was. So, unfortunately, I think that's still needed. So, amongst my peers, last thing I'll say on this is that it's guys over 50, well, guys over 60, it's zero. And I don't think that any of them will be able to adjust. Even ones that have invested in venture capital firms that are involved in the space, they don't. You know, they very, very few. When I mean zero, I just mean a near zero number. And over 40, I think the number is still very small, very. And then under 35, and I don't know that many people under 35, but under 35, I think the adoption rate is much easier, much quicker. So what we're talking about is a massive wealth transfer that's going to happen from the old people who don't understand it to the young people who it's second nature for.
So I think that's really interesting, the actual, as a wealth redistribution, I think that's a very interesting concept. You know, one of the things I've been trying to get over recently is that people have been talking about, oh, when are the institutions come in, and then getting excited when BACT arrives, and then getting disappointed when there's little to no volume. I really think Bitcoin is very much a movement of people. And I think by the time the institutions will arrive, will almost be, you know, we could be years away from that. And so I think we, as a, like a community, people should stop focusing and worrying about the institutions. I think it's much more about individuals and how we educate them and get them up to speed quickly. Because, you know, I don't know about you, but I'm like 2.5 years in and I'm still learning.
Yeah, I think that's right to some degree. But, you know, the institutions, as, you know, as they're referred to, really are a massive different group, is comprised of many different groups. So as an example, I think that there are probably a lot of, you know, successful fund managers that have invested in the venture capital firms in the space who are funding the companies who are in the space. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Coinbase goes out and does a raise in December, and they raise from Tiger, which is a, you know, big hedge fund complex. They raise money from, I can't remember who else, but I think maybe Union Square or Andreessen or whoever it was. So, you know, the institutions are playing it in that space. is my guess. I mean, to some degree, because they don't want to deal with owning the Bitcoin. They don't want to figure out, you know, how to deal with it. And again, it's still an extremely small number of people. And I think it's starting a little bit. And I know this firsthand, but I can't really get into it. Why? Okay. But it's definitely, let's just say, it's early in the first inning. So
yeah,
that tells you. But it's in the first inning. It's not, you know, there is a game. People are aware of the game, and it's in the first inning. But it's remarkable. Again, I'm not so sure that it's the fault of the older people. You know, after you've had some success in this world, and you figure out your way of being successful, I mean, in the business world, most people are not really looking for a new paradigm. You know, they're not looking for a new way. And so you have the people who run the Wall Street banks and accountant firms. But, you know, you have some of the accounting firms are really advanced, at least in trying to figure out how to apply, you know, blockchain. And I don't like this whole thing because you can't like blockchain and not Bitcoin. That whole concept is ridiculous. Like, it's all Bitcoin.
Yeah. So right. Are you a maximalist?
Well, I don't know. No, I don't know if I'm a maximalist, but the invention, the value, the, you know, is the Bitcoin solution, the network, the framework, and the store of value and everything else. And look, I have nothing against Ethereum and their interesting projects that go on. I listened to Laura Shin the other day. She had some woman on who was doing something very funky and integrated with the Ethereum platform that had real world application. And this woman's business saves people in rural areas, you know, $100, you know, off their cable bill because they're sharing excess Wi-Fi capacity or something like that. I'm not very good with that details, but like I know enough to know that that's a project that's creating value for somebody. It's not Bitcoin, but you know, look, I mean, there's Coke and then there's Pepsi, you know, and I don't want to say it's like that because I think Bitcoin, you know, is the thing.
Yeah. People prefer there's Bitcoin and then there's shitcoins.
You know what? I think that's very bad for the space. Like I think people should stop that actually, you know, using that terminology. And again, I'm not really big on cursing, especially in public.
Oh man, don't follow me on Twitter then. I curse a lot.
I'm not big on it because I just think it's unnecessary. But I think that like being demeaning to something kind of like that, it's just, you know, there are a lot of very smart people who are 10 times smarter than me and you, who spend their life working on non-Bitcoin crypto projects. And so I don't feel comfortable dismissing that type of talent with an epithet. So
I think that's
I think that it's, you know, there's some goofy parts about this community that also keep people away from it, that make, you know, keep adoption, make adoption more difficult.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think I agree with you to some extent. I'm probably more on the ridiculous side myself sometimes because it's all a bit of fun to me sometimes. But I appreciate your point there.
Well, there's nothing wrong with a little fun. I'm all for a little fun. Don't get me wrong. But, you know, look, I see this whole world from an outsider perspective, and I look at the level of talent of the people engaged. And it's higher than certainly anything that I've ever seen in finance or in the investment world. Maybe, you know, 25 years ago, maybe there's a more smaller group and the talent was higher. But I don't think that the people, you know, in that business are as high quality as the people in this business, especially under 35. I think the under 35 people who are innovative, creative, who are entrepreneurial, who want to make something new, who want to make money, who want to be engaged in the future. They're not going into a macro hedge fund. They're not going into the investment business to be long bonds or stocks. It's a very uninteresting world with not great economic or financial prospects compared to this one. And so I think, and if some of those younger people are involved with projects that aren't Bitcoin, you know, they're going to find ways to make things happen. And I think we should be encouraging them, even though to me, yes, you know, Bitcoin is the gold standard.
All right. Well, listen, look, before we finish, there is another area I want to touch with you. You are a macro thinker. It seems to me that at the moment there's a lot of crazy stuff going on. I'm not a financial guy, but I'm reading about negative interest rates, which seem crazy. It seems like China and the US, whilst having a trade war, they're also both trying to stimulate their economies. It feels like everything's going a bit weird. Kind of from your perspective and as an experienced macro guy, what's going on, man?
Yeah, I hear you on that. I think, you know, there are different time frames that I think about, you know, that I used to think about a macro framework. And so I think about, like, okay, let's start with today. I think today, you know, and the last 6 to 18 months, the world economy has been slowing. And I think the data has shown that. The problems with the U.S. and China, you know, to just think very simply, you know, the U.S.-China nexus was the growth engine, really, for the world for 15 years, and now it's fracturing. So de facto, things can't be, you know, as good as they were. There's a change and there's an adjustment, and people are trying to figure out what to do. If I have a business and I'm thinking about expanding in Asia, I'm probably not going to expand in China today, whereas 5-10 years ago, I might have. But look, I don't think this lasts forever either. I just think today there's uncertainty with that. And the Federal Reserve also, I think, has made a mistake and raised rates too much. And I think that contributed to some of the problems that we had last year in December. You know, the markets basically completely collapsed. And it was only in early January when the Federal Reserve basically did an about face on policy that the markets also reversed course. So, and then since then, you've seen many central banks from, you know, across the world ease interest rates. And again, a lot of people say, oh, well, this is the traditional financial world interest rates. They don't do anything. You know, 17 trillion negative bonds. The economy in Europe is still soft. You know, yes and no. I think, look, on balance, when the central banks all together get together and say we're going to make liquidity plentiful and we're going to lower rates, that liquidity then goes to places and it goes to markets, it goes to stocks, it goes to gold, it goes to, you know, it used to go to bonds in some case, certainly it goes to credit. So, and then that leads another demand cycle. And people say, well, we've exhausted that. We've been doing that for, you know, 30 years more. I'm like, I'm aware of all that. But it still, on balance, has an effect. And so I think that the Fed recently, in the last few months, has reversed, you know, from what was neutral. They were tightening, then neutral, and now to actually easing. And hopefully they'll continue to drop rates and make liquidity more plentiful because the data warrants it. The issue is that, you know, and this is the first time I've seen this in my career, is that, you know, Trump, you know, if you had to say to me, like, what's the one thing today that's different than anything you've ever seen? It's just that the political interference in the process of the economic management that's done by the Federal Reserve and probably to some degree the Treasury, it's never been as, you know, I would say impinged upon by a president as we have today. And it's really having impact. You know, he watches the stock market, and when the market's at a high, he becomes more aggressive with China, and then the market goes back down, and down 5-10%, and then he says, okay, well, we're coming close to a deal. and then he'll start attacking the Fed as well. And, you know, the Fed's been too tight. They should be easing more. He even said a month or two ago, we should have, you know, zero or negative rates because the other countries are doing it. The dollar is too strong. We've never had a president, I mean, since I can remember, since following things, you know, Reagan, Bush, Clinton, Bush, no one ever was on top of the markets like this in a, almost like a daily fashion. So my guess is that he is going to want the stock market up into the election of November 20. So I am centering my views on that expectation that he will get the macro policies that he needs. And it, that means if the Fed doesn't accommodate and continue to ease rates, if the data stays soft, and I, again, I think it stays soft to neutral, that, you know, there's a potential that he really starts to talk down the dollar. And this is some things that non-macro, non-financial people don't understand, which is that the Treasury is responsible for the dollar, not the Fed. And it is perfectly legitimate and legal for the Treasury to take any stance that it wants on the dollar. Yeah. And, you know, I think the strength of the dollar in the last few years has been a reflection of overly tight Fed policy. So Trump does actually have a real case to make here that the dollar is too strong and that it needs, I mean, you have even official bodies like the IMF and World Bank, others, you know, that needs a structural downshift. And, you know, to step back for a second and just, you know, to understand why, I mean, look, you know, 15, 20 years ago, the U.S. was a much larger percentage of world GDP than it is today. You know, the U.S. dollar is still the world's reserve currency, but there are other, you know, but it's not the same percentage of world GDP. So there's an upward bias to the dollar because people hold it in reserves. And the Fed policy being too tight also complicates things and makes the dollar stronger. So if he, you know, so I'm coming up with my macro thought in a backwards way. I'm saying, how, what do I think will happen to ensure that the market is near its high on November 20, which is not something I usually do. I don't usually think this way. But when you have an election like this and you have a president who will go in and manipulate the markets, and I don't say that in some sort of evil way, but he will to ensure that he gets his results, you know, I can go with that. So what does that mean? I think things are slowing. I think liquidity will be plentiful. There's a possibility that China has just recently eased and that the ECB has maybe shifted towards a little more of an easing bias. Just in the last few days, I've been starting to think maybe, you know, maybe there's been acknowledgement globally, and I'm not sure exactly. So I would say you caught me right now at a moment where I'm contemplating whether there's been a macro shift or not.
Interesting.
But then just to, you know, to finish up, I would say that if the Fed does not accommodate the weakness and the stock market does have a problem, if it does in the next few months, Trump and Mnuchin will come out to engineer a softer dollar. And that could mean 10, 15%. And if that happens, again, it's bullish for gold. It'll be bullish for stocks. But I think that that, you know, kicks off and also highlights the debate around Bitcoin. Because, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago, there wasn't really, you know, the sense that, you know, fiat was being debased by authorities and, you know, that there was intervention pre-08, which was a massive government intervention. We really didn't have that so much. And every time they come in and intervene that way, it just makes the case for Bitcoin stronger.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think it's an epiphany moment. If the dollar went down 30-40%, which I don't see right now, that would further put Bitcoin into the spotlight, in my opinion.
Yeah, interesting, because that's the discussions I've had with a few people recently. You know, will Bitcoin become a safe haven asset? And right now, it doesn't appear enough of people are considering it one. It, you know, the
I'm not saying it has to be necessarily a safe haven asset.
Okay.
I think Bitcoin goes up regardless, and I think Bitcoin goes up for a lot of different reasons. 80% of the reasons we haven't even discussed today.
Okay.
But the concept of an alternative currency, a hard money, does not necessarily mean it's a safe haven. You know, I think gold is probably more of a traditional safe haven. And gold is infinitely more liquid than Bitcoin. So the people who have assets, they want a safe haven. Like, you know, they're not choosing between Bitcoin and gold because gold is much more liquid. You might have some flow into gold. But the concept that an alternative financial system, alternative banking system, a whole new world is growing up. I mean, this would be my thought. A whole new world is growing up alongside the legacy framework. And so I just think that what will happen is, you know, the whole ecosystem plus the market cap of Bitcoin and all the coins is around $350 billion. That's the value of the equity plus Bitcoin and the altcoins. You know, one day, people in the legacy system will wake up and it'll be $2 trillion. And then the next day, they'll wake up and it'll be $4 trillion. And so at some point, you know, there'll be a flourishing system that, you know, will be in some way, I think, will be somewhat integrated with the legacy system, but not at this point, or no, but it's going to continue to grow alongside, if you see what I'm saying, as opposed to a replacement. And so I don't see that necessarily as a safe haven, more like an alternative, and that there is a difference.
Interesting, interesting. Well, listen, I find it very interesting at the moment. I've been kind of, I can't decide whether with Bitcoin it's going to become like this thing that could potentially take over, or it's just going to be like an asset that sits on the side. You know, I just don't know, but I find the whole thing exciting. I do feel a lot more confident when I speak to somebody like you, though, and hear you're a supporter of Bitcoin. I don't know, it just makes me feel like, feels like I've made the right bet.
I think there's a chance it takes over eventually.
Wow.
Just, I'm not the only guy. You know, I may be early in my world, but I you know, there are lots of guys a lot smarter than me who are gonna, in my world, who haven't figured it out, who will. So it's just the moat is very high, and that's good for all of us, because the longer it takes them, the longer and more meaningful the opportunity is for us.
So we need to keep stacking sats while we wait.
Exactly. Everyone out there should keep stacking sats. I love that theme.
All right. Well, listen, I think that's a good point to end it. We've done a good hour. I do think one of my next visits to New York, though, we should do one of these in person, because I think we could go through a whole bunch of different things. That other 80% of reasons why you think Bitcoin will be a success, I think, would be an interesting show on its own. But before we close out, Dan, one thing that would be good, you can just let people know how they can follow your work, your companies.
Yeah, I've recently, just on Twitter, DTAP Cap, that's my investment firm, DTAP Cap, DTAP Capital. I go Bullion International is, you can go to our website if you're interested. We do sell physical gold directly. And I'm actually going to be launching a new venture in the next few months that is in the Bitcoin space.
Okay.
But I'm not going to get into that. Maybe next time we could chat about that.
You can announce that on my show if you want. Get out to a massive audience. You'll be welcome to do that. But I'd certainly, when I'm next in New York, we should definitely meet up and do this.
Yeah, I really enjoyed this. I really enjoyed this chat. Yeah.
All right, Dan. Well, listen, best luck with everything you do. Keep telling people to stack sats, educating the people in your world about Bitcoin. I think that's super useful. And yeah, thank you so much for coming on the show. Okay, so what do you think of that? Did you enjoy listening to Dan? I did. I think his perspective was pretty cool. It's pretty interesting having him on the show and hear him speak so positively about Bitcoin, especially coming from gold. And with a background like Dan's, it was just really interesting to hear about him talk about how he thinks Bitcoin could take over the legacy financial systems and enable this huge wealth redistribution. So it's very cool. So lots to be bullish on with this show. And if you did like it and you haven't already listened to my interview with Raoul Pyle, I recommend you go back and check that one out. Also, my show with Stefan Levera is another pretty good one, which kind of feels like it fits alongside this in some ways. Anyway, thank you, Dan. Thanks for coming on. Hopefully, we'll do this in person sometime. And if you've got any feedback about the show, do reach out to me. It's hello@whatbitcoindid.com if you do want to support the show. If you are a regular listener, you haven't done any of these things and you want to help me, please do head over to my website, whatbitcoindid.com. Click on the support section. Anything from leaving a review to becoming a patron, it all helps with the show. As I said, I'm in New York now. I'm going to be here till Friday and then it's back to Bedford. If you've got any questions, do hit me up. My email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com.